The recording has started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the All Rights Protection Mechanisms, RPMs, and All GTLD PDP Working Group call held on the 13th of December, 2017. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call as we have quite a few participants. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connected Room. At this time on audio only, I show J. Scott Evans and Brian Beckham. Anyone else on telephone only at this time?
Rebecca.
Thank you, Rebecca. Hearing no more names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to co-chair Kathy Kleinman. Please begin.
Thank you so much. This is Kathy Kleinman, and it looks like we've lost John Barry. No, it looks like he's back. That's great. Well, welcome to our members and also observers to a special meeting today. Today we are going to be going through the URS rules, the rules of the Uniform Rapid Suspension. We went through the procedure in Abu Dhabi at ICANN 60, and staff has recirculated those slides. And of course, the procedure and the rules work together to give us both the substantive and procedural rules, although, ironically, a number of the substantive rules are actually in the URS procedure. Just a quick note on that. So today we're going to be going through, we have a number of slides, and we're going to be going through the URS rules. And we're going to be doing it with some expert guides. We've got Doug Eisenberg and John Berryhill with us today. And these are both very senior attorneys operating in the area. Not that they're old, just that they've been involved for a very long time. Both Doug and John go back to before the days of ICANN, working in the domain name dispute arena. And they worked under the old Network Solutions domain name dispute policy. And so they were around at the birth of the UDRP, and both have actively been involved in UDRP and now URF proceedings. Doug also serves as a panelist for WIPO, the Forum, the Czech Arbitration Center, and the British Columbia International Commercial Arbitration Center. And John works with CCTLD domain name disputes for .us, .uk, .eu, and others, as well as for GTLDs. We've got bios and pictures so that you can associate pictures with the voices. And I just want to add something that's not on the bios, that Doug is very famous for his Gigala blog, which a number of us read on a regular basis to keep up with news in the internet world. And John Berryhill is almost as famous for his tweets as President Trump. So we are very happy to have both of these individuals with us today. The format for today's discussion, oh, it sounds like you're getting static on my line. I hope that's, let me just pause. Is there still static on my line?
Hi, Kathy, it's Terry. Yes, there certainly is.
There's a lot of stuff. Okay, I will call back in after I introduce the first section of the slides. Let's. Can you hear me well enough to wait for another minute or two?
Yes, Kathy, we can.
Okay, terrific. Then the format today is that staff is going to take us through the URS rules with slides, but we're not going to do all the slides at once. We're going to go section by section. We're going to pause for comments and feedback from our guests, and then open to questions section by section from members and observers who want to interact and ask questions of these two individuals who have so much experience in this area. Okay, Seth, let me turn it over to you, and I will dial back in.
Hi, everybody. This is Mary from staff, and as Kathy said, today we're going to focus on the URS rules. After the call today, of course, we'll have the usual recording and transcript. We will be posting these slides to the Working Group Wiki space as well, alongside the slides that we used at the session in ICANN 60, where we also presented a similar overview on the framework for these rules, that is the underlying URS procedure. So while these slides are fairly text-heavy, the intention is that these slides, like the ones on the URS procedure, will serve as informational reference points, so we probably will not be reading or, you know, touching on every point today. Instead, we will provide a general description of each step in the URS process and invite Doug and John to share their comments and insights as we go along. So just some preliminary notes on the URS rules to start with. The effective date, June 2013, and I think as everyone knows, but it's worth pointing out, these rules apply to all proceedings brought under the URS procedure, but like the URS, applies only to domains that were registered in GTLDs delegated under the current new GTLD program. In addition to the procedure, these rules, there are also supplemental rules that differ in some respect from provider to provider. At the end of these slides, we have included references to the current set of providers as well as links to each of the supplemental rules. And of course, we do have representatives from some of the providers as participants in this working group, so I'd like to invite them to jump in with comments as well as we go along. So if we just start with the first step in the process, and again, please read these slides in the context of the overarching underlying procedure. We had noted previously that the complaint is to be filed electronically in the English language. There are filing fees that are set out in the provider's supplemental rules in each provider as to what that is. And those have to come in with the complaint, because if they are not submitted within one business day, then the complaint is automatically dismissed. The rest of this slide sets out exactly what must be in the complaint, which are fairly obvious and self-evident, so I'm not going to go through them all. But in addition to specific requirements that need to be in the complaint form, there needs to be an agreement to submit to jurisdiction in at least one mutual jurisdiction, and mutual jurisdiction is defined as you see here, similar to the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy, as a matter of fact. So there are certain specific elements that have to be filled into the complaints form. And in addition to those specific elements of information, there is the possibility of providing some free form text in the form of an optional explanatory statement, but that is limited to 500 words. So essentially, the way the complaint form is set out, including this additional option, is in line with the intention behind the URS for it to be a rapid procedure that's fairly lightweight. At this point, perhaps we can pause, because the next step is what happens after a complaint is filed and the provider has to notify the respondent. So it may be appropriate for me to stop at this point and invite Doug and John to see if you have any comments on filing a complaint or suggestions.
Sure. This is Doug. I'll just make a couple of quick comments on some content from the slides, but first, I'll just add to the introduction, just to be a little more thorough. I have filed, I took a look before this call, about 25 complaints under the URS that total involve about 175 domain names. So obviously, a number of those URS complaints have included multiple domain names. I think the largest was about 85 domain names. And as was mentioned, I do serve as an expert as well and have issued about 20 determinations. But I'm happy to share my thoughts really in my experience in filing complaints. And one thing I would just note from a slide that was a slide or two back, The note on the slide that said that the URS applies only to the new GTLDs, I think, as this group probably knows, that's not exactly correct. There are a handful, I believe about six other GTLDs as well as one CCTLD that have adopted the URS as well. Not that we've seen many determinations with respect to those other top-level domains, but that is accurate, I believe, as well as there is another policy that I'm sure everybody is familiar with, which is the USRS, which is a variation of the URS that applies to the .us CCTLD. And just one other quick comment based on the slides themselves. There was a note, I believe, I saw about the English language requirement for the complaint itself, and I believe, Mary, you'll address these in later slides as we go through the rules. But it's not quite as simple as it may seem, because as the complaint may be in English, as the complaint must be in English, there are some additional rules that apply to the response itself, which certainly affects the entirety of the proceeding. So I just had those couple of comments to begin with, and I don't know if John has anything else to add.
Yeah, I just had one minor point. There is a trap for the unwary built in here, where down it says the complainant must state the goods or services for which the mark is used, including evidence of use, which can be submitted directly with the URS complaint with the assigned mark data record from the trademark clearinghouse. The problem with that that I've seen complainants have is that the signed mark data from the trademark clearinghouse is just sort of a receipt saying that a record was filed with the trademark clearinghouse. There's actually no way for the panel or parties to verify anything in the trademark clearinghouse. And in one URS that I was, you know, defending, you know, the panelist even pointed out that, well, you know, submitting this receipt that you got from the trademark clearinghouse is great, but it doesn't provide it doesn't provide the URS panel with evidence, you know, or even a way to verify evidence of anything. So, you know, on the complainant side, if you have a trademark clearinghouse record, that's great. But if you just submit that as the evidence of your trademark use, it's going to be deficient, because there's no external way to actually, you know, verify a trademark clearinghouse record as opposed to, say, you know, a normal public trademark registration.
This is Kathy, hopefully on a clearer line. Let me just check, is this a clear line? Okay, I'm hoping it is. Thanks to both Doug and John. Does anyone have any initial questions right now about the complaint? Otherwise, we'll continue to the next portion of the slides. Oh, thank you, Terry. I'm glad it's a clear line. Okay, terrific. Thanks, and back to Mary.
Thanks, Kathy, Doug, and John. And as Kathy notes, we will be stopping after each section, so if you have questions, feel free to ask them then, although, of course, we will have time at the end for discussion and more questions. George, I think you just raised your hand. Do you have a question about the complaint step in the procedure?
Yes, George Krikos for the transcript. What was the logic behind the language being in English, given that a very high proportion of registrations in UGTLDs turn out to be in China? Thanks.
Doug or John, do you want to respond to that?
I don't know the background on that, so no, I don't know that I'm in a position to address that.
Okay.
Yeah, same here. It's a good question. I think part of it was because it runs on such a rapid time scale, and there is I don't know how to put it, sort of a common denominator language among at least the panel. That there may have been some concern about getting a panelist in the appropriate language quickly. Of course, you know, that doesn't help a respondent who doesn't speak English and who has, you know, 14 days. But I'm not aware of the particular rationale.
The only thing I might add to that, and this is anecdotal, is I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I believe it's correct, that the overwhelming majority of UDRP cases in which there is a different language requirement, which refers generally to the language of the registration agreement, most UDRP proceedings are conducted in English, so at least historically, English has been the predominant language in domain name dispute cases.
Well, one other distinction that you could make is, and it's a subtle one, the difference between the URS and the UDRP, is that the UDRP is a registrar-level policy. That is, the registrar is going to determine whether to transfer or not transfer a name. The URS operates at the registry level. That is the registry which implements the decision. The registrar is actually kind of left out of the loop, and many of the registries operate in English. So it does run independently of the registrar agreement.
Phil Corwin is asking a question in the chat room. So let's see, Doug or John, if you know, how rapidly is the complaint translated where the translation would be warranted based on the registrant's domicile?
I'm not sure I've had any experience with a URS proceeding in which there has been a translation. I'm not sure exactly which rule, Phil, maybe you can clarify you're referring to as far as where a translation would actually occur. I'm not sure where that would take place.
This is Phil. If I can just, since you asked me, I was just wondering, let's say a URS is filed against a registrant in China who has to respond to it, if they're going to respond rapidly, how quickly would such a registrant get a translation to understand the nature of the complaint against them?
Well,
Be non-compliant.
Or do they have to request a translation, I guess, would be another aspect.
I suppose, like everything I'll say during this call, subject to my taking a look and correcting myself, I don't think a translation is provided as or contemplated as a part of the URS proceeding itself, and the burden would be on the registrant to obtain its own translation.
Yeah, I mean, the rules specify English, and yeah, I would imagine that at least the NAF would probably just reject it as non-compliant absent an English translation. In the UDRP context, sometimes the language issue gets, you know, batted around for about a week or so. But I don't think it's even come up in the URS.
This is Kathy. As Mary has noted, there is a translation, Mary and Yvette, there is a translation of the notice that's provided for in the URS rules and some provision for responses in other languages by the respondent, by the registrant. But I think you're right that the complaint itself is not translated by the provider. So that's an issue for us to think about. I think it's back to Mary to continue in the slides.
Thanks, Kathy and everyone. And actually, this next slide does fit in with that discussion somewhat. We also note that we can go back and look at the background to the reason why some of these rules are the way they are. So it's already been explained, I think, just by Kathy too and Yvette in the chat, that there is no obligation on the provider to translate the complaint on anyone. However, in terms of a complaint being notified, this slide sets out what it is that the provider must do and when. a lot of this is under the actual procedure itself that we covered briefly at ICANN 60. So what we've done here is provide a summary of the specific timelines and obligations and who is to be notified, the registry operator for locking the domain within a certain period of time, and of course I think the notice to the registrant with those requirements under the procedure as to it requiring to be clear and understandable and how it is to be sent. This is supplemented by the rules, and again we come back to the language issue, and here is where the notice must be translated, and we've reproduced the actual language of the rules here to show you what the obligation is. And I know that there's been a comment in the chat about predominant language. In terms of actually transmitting the notice in these languages, the provider is required to employ reasonably available means that are calculated to achieve actual notice. We have provided the links to the actual rules, so it would be helpful, I think, for folks to look at the rules themselves. There is actually a full section in the rules, I believe it's section 9, that talks about language, and you'll see that, as Doug mentioned, there are different requirements with regard to the language of a complaint, the language for notifying a respondent of a complaint, and then when we get to it, a language in terms of a response that a registrant may wish to provide. So there's only this one slide on the notification step. Again, I'll pause and see if Doug and John wish to make comments and as well as invite questions from folks on the call.
I've never encountered any notification issues in my participation so far in the URS process, so I don't have anything to add on this slide.
John, did you want to comment on this as well?
You have to consider notice issues. I mean, there are a lot of defaults in there, and there are lots of reasons why there are defaults under the URS, and I don't think most of them are due to lack of notice. One of the things about the URS, since it is, you know, relatively new and has been applied to the new GTLDs, is that you have a lot of fresh registrant data. That is, these aren't people that have, you know, registered a domain name several years ago and then moved several times, and you know, the uppermost thing on their mind upon moving wasn't changing the whois in their domain that's been working fine for years. So obviously I don't hear about a URS proceeding unless someone has, you know, obtained notice and come to me for advice on responding or not responding or how to respond. The other end of this, though, is that in the, in the URS, one can actually default and then show up with, you know, an explanation for the default and a substantive response. You know, and part of that's due to the fact that, you know, in the EDRP, the domain name is going to be transferred, and there's not a good way to transfer it back. But under the URS, since the domain name is turned off, you know, whether the respondent receives late notice or, I mean, they'll certainly, you know, obtain notice if their domain name is disabled, presumably, if they cared. You know, the lack of notice issues don't have the same sort of gravity under the URS that they do under the UDRP, since the ultimate result is, you know, it's just a matter of turning the domain name back on if there was, you know, some horrible miscarriage.
Great. Thanks, John. Thanks, Doug. Let me ask you both, there's a question in the chat. Do you know how the provider send the hard copy? Is it courier or some other way? Do you have experience with that, the hard copy notice?
Yeah, I don't have experience with that in the URS. I know that WIPO has taken to sending out in the UDRP side, you know, a postcard or some kind of paper notification, which through international mail, you know, typically shows up a day or two response is due, or I've seen them arrive even after the response is due. You know, it's difficult to run an international policy on a 14-day time scale and, you know, count on delivery of anything, you know, physical being a reliable method.
Yeah, I would just add, I agree with John. I don't, I'm not aware of a delay in physical delivery of notice becoming an issue, but without representatives of some of the providers who may be participating in this call on the spot, maybe they can clarify if they would like to do so, how that physical notice is actually provided.
Good point. Good point. And we will be having providers on the call later on, as Mary notes. Jay Scott, one of our other co-chairs, asks, do either of you have any examples of this being an issue? And I'm assuming this is notice, Jay Scott. If not, please let me know. So of notice being an issue.
I'm not aware of any.
No. No. Over the years, I've heard from people, and in fact, I heard from someone just recently that lost the UDRP case and never knew it was going on. I mean, you know, that happens in the UDRP. Under URS, I wouldn't really. I mean, the registrant at the time of registration, presumably provided accurate contact information. Now there could be all kinds of issues with, you know, delivery of email. But again, since it applies to the new GTLDs and that registrant data should be relatively fresh, then, you know, there's a higher confidence in the email address being accurate than, say, a domain name that's been registered for, you know, a number of years.
That's a good point. But just to reiterate, John, I think what you said a minute ago, because presumably, well, perhaps the URS will be around for a long time, and at some point we'll have domain names registered 10 or 20 years ago that are the subject of a URS proceeding, anything's possible, that unlike the UDRP, in which the transfer decision can be implemented, perhaps without the respondent having received notice if there's inaccurate contact information maintained. In the case of a URS proceeding, as you said, a respondent who does not file a response and loses the determination will have its domain name suspended, which will be an obvious sign that something has occurred, especially since the notice indicates that the domain name is suspended as a result of a URS determination, and will then have, as I think we'll get to in a few slides, an opportunity to still file a response and reactivate its domain name while the case is sort of repending.
And Jay Scott asks, do you know of any cases where respondents have come forward seeking, in his words, seeking to redress due to lack of notice or perhaps asking for an appeal based on a default?
No, I'm not aware of any.
John, no. Do you know of any cases? Okay. Great. And last question, and then we'll move on to the next slide. Paul Keating asks, is a late response stating that they did not understand the language of the complaint considered as a valid reason?
I think a late response can be filed for any reason.
Yeah, you just have to pay a fee, I believe.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks for the back and forth. Back to Mary.
Thanks, everyone. And again, I'll just try and go quickly through these slides and leave the time for comments and questions. We have two slides on filing a response. And again, this is framed by the requirements under the procedure. And Doug's already mentioned part of this, that while initially there was a 14 calendar day period from the date of the notice of the complaint, it's possible to have extensions of these period, and it's also possible to file a response even after a default determination, for example. There is a provision for a fee, but that is where the complaint is for 15 or more domains. So again, we've covered these previously, and the rules here enhance those requirements under the procedure by basically providing that you have to submit a response request for extension in accordance with whichever provider it is and their supplemental rules. It's also possible for the parties to stipulate to an extended response period. And just as with the complaint, there are certain elements that are required in a response. First of all, there is a word limit that's specified under the procedure, and the rules go into some detail as to what the response should include. The main point here at the end of this, I think, again, we all know this, that if no response is submitted, and again, there is that initial 14 calendar day period, then the complaint proceeds to default determination by the examiner, and we'll look at that next. So again, I'm over to Doug and John for your comments.
Well, maybe the next slide will address it, so forgive me. But just to be clear, a default determination is not necessarily a determination in favor of the complainant to suspend. Instead, the expert still has to issue a determination based on the merits of the proceeding.
Yeah, one thing worth pointing out is sharp-eyed observer may have noticed that the complainant is allowed 500 words and the respondent is allowed 2,500 words. And just to review the rationale for that, this policy was designed for, those sort of no-brainer cases, right? The ones where you look at, for example, the WIPO UDRP pending list and you can look at most of them and say, oh, okay, well, we know where that's going to go. So to file a complaint, say, this is my trademark. Here's what the website's doing. It was in the TMCH and they had notice of it. It's fairly simple to say, clearly here are the facts making out a claim of abuse of registration. The problem with that is, when you get into defenses like, demonstrable preparations to use the domain name and so forth, you'll have to, go through exhibits. Here's, where we contracted for the website operator and so forth. So these things should be clear on their face. And so it's very simple to make an accusation that here's my trademark, there's the domain name, here's a web page, it's violating my mark. Whereas the explaining those circumstances can sometimes take a little bit more in the way of evidence and explanation to make it clear where, for example, I had one on the word hello that I was defending. Now, I don't know how much detail or you need to provide to, express the fact that hello is a common word, but, I like to back up assertions with evidence. So, I don't take it for granted that, necessarily someone's going to believe that hello is a common word without evidence of it. So, the reason for that asymmetry is in a case designed for, extremely clear claims of abuse of registration, it shouldn't really take a whole lot to make that claim. But some of the defenses sort of invite a longer explanation of things like, demonstrable preparations to use or, evidence of my pre-existing business, using the name and so forth.
And
before anyone, notices that and cries foul.
I think John makes excellent points, and we sort of glossed over that a few slides back about the word limits in the complaint itself. So, yeah, there's certainly an asymmetry, as John says, between the 500 words allowed in the complaint and the 2,500 words allowed in the response. But just to maybe sort of highlight how limiting both of those are, under the UDRP, by comparison, the service providers and their supplemental rules set limits on the filings, and at the forum, there are page limits rather than word limits. So I think actually making a comparison to the WIPO supplemental rules for UDRP is maybe the better comparison. And there, the word limits for both complaints and responses are 5,000 words. So you can imagine that a filing that is half of that or a tenth of that makes it challenging for parties to include all of the factual and legal arguments that they would like to make, especially when you consider, for example, that it's appropriate and common to cite precedent that has previous domain name dispute decisions, which themselves often account for many words when you simply look at the style name of a case. You know, a party that may be a few words versus the name of another party that may be a few words, and you know, forum claim number, and then the number itself, you know, you've eaten up a relatively large number of words just citing to one particular case. So it's a significant restriction, the word limits that exist in the rules.
Yeah, and again, that takes into account the fact that, you know, it's got to be, you know, something of a no-brainer. I mean, you know, a guy walked up to the street, up to me on the street, stuck a gun in my face and took my wallet, and, you know, here's a picture of it occurring, you know, doesn't require a whole lot of, you know, lengthy legal argument to understand that that's, you know, some form of armed robbery. The response, and, you know, 2,500 words can be a little cramped for a response. You gain a certain efficiency in the responses because of the number of affirmative defenses that are expressly built into the URS and encapsulate, you know, certain common UDRP-type scenarios, but we'll pick up those later.
Great. Thank you both. Right, so hearkening back to that this was a faster, cheaper proceeding, we have the fewer words and the constraints that those offer. I don't see other questions in, are there any questions? I don't see other questions in the chat room. I don't see hands raised. So thank you for the discussion, and Mary, let's move on with the slides.
This is Mary from staff again, and we did think it would be helpful to include the next slide, a single slide, pointing out the rules about communications. We've already talked a little bit about the languages, and you see that in the last bullet point and sub-bullet points here, where we've attempted to summarize what language the complaint, the response, and so forth is in. We note that there is a requirement that the examiner to be appointed has to be fluent in English and in the language of the respondent, although he or she has the discretion to decide the language in which to issue the determination. The rest of this slide just talks about how the communications are to be made, for example, electronically, and essentially the time and date stamp for each type of communication. So, again, Doug and John, do you have any comments on these rules?
No, I think the language issue is an interesting one, but we've already addressed it, and frankly, I don't have experience in any proceedings where it has become an issue.
Yeah, it one minor nit that comes along is that the providers have taken to using, you know, online platforms where in the initial email to the respondent there is some, you know, login token or code, which can be a little bit difficult when the engages counsel to file the response, tracking down that code and making sure that code is actually not the respondent but the respondent's counsel can be a little just annoying. But nothing here that I see that's particularly fodder for controversy in the context of this proceeding.
John, your comment actually does remind me of one other thing. Sorry to jump around a bit, and so feel free to get me back on track if necessary. But one other issue we did not address in the filings are the exhibits or the annexes, which is not the communications and language slide that's on the screen now, but was a few slides back when we were talking about word limits. There are some but the portal, I think, that John, that you're referring to, that in particular the forum uses, and I think it's worth noting that the forum is far and away the most active provider of URS proceedings. So I think that's probably why we talk about them more frequently than the others, not for any other reason. But that there is a very rigid system not only for submitting that sort of preform text of the 500 words in the complaint or the 2,500 words in the response, but also for the submission of the annexes as well. For example, in a complaint, I know there are three specific annexes that and only those three that can be uploaded through the online filing portal.
Right, and regardless of the language, you know, and even if this wasn't primarily run in English, you know, in EDRP, for example, regardless of the language of the proceeding, that portal runs in English.
Okay. Dr. John, this is Kathy again. We have some, speaking of going back a few slides, we've got some questions in the chat room. Let's see if we can kind of run through them fairly quickly. I'm working backwards. Can a single complaint against a single registrant be joined by multiple complainants, so a consolidation of plaintiffs?
I see where Mary's quoted from the procedure itself. I'm not sure which paragraph that is, but I think that's very helpful. I'd also note that the rules speak specifically to defining complainant as the party, which perhaps implies a single entity. But again, I just have not seen this arise in practice as an issue.
Okay. Back to translations. Without translations of the complaints, how are respondents expected to engage with individual claims? This may be asked and answered.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything further to add than what we've said before.
Okay. And Jay Scott asked a question for Doug. Have you ever felt that the word limitation caused you to be unable to set a prima facie case?
I don't know that I would go so far as to say unable, but it makes for some awkward 500-word reading sometimes. Certainly a slightly larger number of words, doesn't have to be 10 times as many as common in a UDRP proceeding, but a few more words would enable, I think, a more appropriate, would be more appropriate to allow for arguments to be made more clearly.
Great. And let's flip the question.
Well, I think also you can look at the numbers at the NAF. There have been, I just back of the envelope, around 679 complaints with, I think, only 58 denials. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that. Obviously, you know, if it works the way it's supposed to for clear-cut claims, you'd expect them all to be granted. But that is a substantially higher success rate for complaints than the UDRP, and I think demonstrates I think in general that IP attorneys get that this is a, you know, sort of a narrower ask, but given that, you know, over 90% success rate, it doesn't seem to have handicapped them.
I will say this. I think as we have a little bit of maturity with the URS, perhaps the 500-word limit becomes a little bit less of a challenge than it was in some of those first cases a few years ago when everybody was sort of going into the process a little bit blindly and therefore trying to make some arguments. But on the same hand, the determinations that we typically receive in URS proceedings don't provide a whole lot to cite anyway, as far as facts or legal arguments. So as far as actually URS filings citing previous URS determinations, there's not a whole lot to go on.
Terrific. Thank you both. Thanks to the people putting questions in the chat room. Back to Mary to continue with the slides.
Thanks, Kathy. And the next slide is a single slide on the examination. I mentioned previously the language issue in relation to the examiner himself or herself. And some of this is in the procedure. And again, the rules basically explain and enhance that procedure. So I won't go through all the rules here because there are certain things in the rules, though, that talk about the powers of the examiner. And I'm not sure that I need to do more than to leave the slide here for folks to look at and perhaps ask John and Doug about their experiences with particular cases or examiners and so forth.
I'm not sure what to add here. Again, I don't have any experience with anything on this slide ever becoming an issue.
Well, you know, one set of numbers that I looked at and picking up on what Doug said about how we reached a certain level of maturity with the EDRP, and, you know, I think what Doug means is, you know, those who've had a lot of experience with it. And, you know, there is a list of examiners and their qualifications, at least in terms of, you know, what their professional qualifications are. They don't seem to be a standard set of qualifications to be an examiner. And going back to sort of the idea of the URS, the simple idea, which of course always gets complicated by the time we run through the ICANN process, was to take care of no-brainers, you know, the simple, very simple, clear-cut, yep, that's the trademark, yep, that's the domain name, yep, that's the website, and it's obviously, you know, relating to the trademark, or the trademark itself is, you know, inherently distinctive and there wouldn't be any non-infringing use for it. One of the things I did notice in the run of UDRP cases, and again, not to pick on any particular provider, it's just that the NAF provides a really good search function for, you know, doing kind of a statistical look at these. Of those 679 decisions, 198 of them, 29%, of the NAF URS decisions were assigned to an examiner who had really no experience with the UDRP prior to doing URS cases. So what I had done was, you know, taking a look at the distribution of cases assigned to examiners at the NAF for URS proceedings. And you go from a high of 34 cases to a low of around 10 or 11. There's a few that have just done one or two URS cases, with the sweet spot around 15 or 16 cases per panelist thus far. For example, Doug has had 17 cases and is kind of in the middle of the pack on that. So then I looked at what is the, you know, how many UDRP cases has this panelist done? And I only searched NAF. So granted, there are a couple of URS panelists now on the NAF roster who had previously not done UDRPs, but I was very surprised at the prevalence of examiners who were apparently assigned to do URS cases with actually no prior experience with the UDRP. And when we talk about sort of a run-of-the-mill UDRP no-brainer case, I know that means something to me, Doug, and probably most of the people here who have experience with the UDRP. But, you know, what sort of impression one gets of a clear and convincing case, sort of under the run-of-the-mill experience that we have all had with domain disputes, you know, maybe some of the question when you have, you know, panelists that really had no prior experience and were given these. And of course, one could say the other way, that if they're that clear, how much experience do they need? But it was kind of an interesting thing to notice that there were a lot of, you know, new names and showing up in a substantial chunk of URS cases. You know, I'm not saying that has had any substantive outcome on the cases, because again, it appears thus far the URS has been used primarily for, you know, what are no-brainer cases. But it's where you have interesting cases where, you know, what exactly are the objective qualifications for examiners, and particularly assigned to the URS, where the parties don't get to provide a whole lot of input or education to whatever panelist might be appointed to it. You know, there is the potential for, you know, perhaps a relatively inexperienced panelist to be dealing with issues that, you know, many UDRP panelists have seen time and time again, but which may be, you know, new to this panelist.
Thank you. Thank you both. There's a question from J. Scott Machet, whether you know how many of these cases were appealed.
Kathy, this is Mary from staff, and I see that Barry's just put the answer in chat, and based on the data that we have collected on the URS to date.
Yep.
Let me just ask, though, I'm not sure if Scott's question was how many of all URS cases have been appealed or how many of the cases to which John was referring.
And J. Scott added from the popular examiner that you were talking about.
So I think a different question was answered than was asked.
Oh, okay. The incidence of appeals is itself relatively low, and the run of cases I think is fairly mundane. I haven't seen, and that's why I was careful to say, I have not seen panelist experience, at least in the data I have, you know, to be. An apparent issue either in terms of appeals, which, you know, are very low. The most popular examiner, the one that has 34, about twice the level of average, I haven't picked through to see if he got it right or got it wrong, and we all have opinions about that. There have been no appeals on the most popular examiner, not popular, most frequent examiner. And I haven't seen any correlation between, actually, of panelists who have either been involved in appeals or have had decisions go to appeal. There's only like onesies and twosies. I think there's only two panelists that have two. There's not enough data to really get any kind of, any kind of trend out of that. And again, it only gets interesting when the case itself is interesting. So that's why I said it was a potential issue of an inexperienced panelist, but, I haven't seen any, I haven't seen anything break as a result of it.
Terrific. Thank you, John. And Barry Cobb, who's our data specialist from ICANN staff, has noted that he'll be updating the URS data that was presented as an initial draft in Abu Dhabi. John, maybe you could share some of the data that you've been generating, share it with Barry, and perhaps we could, if appropriate, include it in our next round of materials. And I don't see any.
Sure. Yeah.
Terrific. Thank you. I don't see any more questions, so back to you, Mary, to continue with the slides.
Thank you. So now we move on to the determination itself at that stage. We have two slides on this, and noting some comments earlier about using the word default, just a reminder here that there still is a determination even if no response was received. There are some requirements under the rules that a notification must still go to the registry operator from the provider so that the content and WHOIS information is not changed. And the overall procedure itself also provides that a notice of default should be sent to the complainant and also to the registrant and through what means. Then we go back to the underlying procedure that specifies, that it's one examiner who has to be trained. And, of course, I think everyone knows that the burden of proof under the URS is clear and convincing evidence. And there is a timeline that's provided in the procedure, not the rules, that presumably was intended to mirror the fast nature of the URS as it was intended to be. So if I can go on to the next slide, the examiner is required to provide a written determination in all cases. Therefore, whether it was a default case because no response was submitted, or whether because there was a response and therefore there needs to be a final determination, or indeed if there is an appeal that results, all cases require a written record of the determination. There is guidance to the examiner as to how to make the determination, and here it does say that it has to be framed within the procedure, the rules, as well as, quote, any rules and principles of law that the examiner deems applicable, close quote. Of course, the reasons have to be stated, and there are some specific instances, perhaps if there is a finding of harassment, that needs to be stated as well. And the written determinations have to be published by the providers on a publicly accessible website. So again, I'll pause here and over to John and Doug.
I would just add that the rules also state that the determinations shall provide the reasons on which it is based. And many determinations, if you've read them or if you want to take a look, are very short. And I think that is by necessity, or at least by design, given the short time period in which experts have to write their determinations. So unfortunately, there's just, as I said a moment ago, there's not a lot of meat in a lot of the determinations.
Yeah, and again, it's, you know, it's doesn't really necessarily mean a whole lot, need a whole lot of meat, and particularly, you know, in, I can't remember what the TLD was, but, you know, doing a dispute on the word hello, or doing a dispute on the word Finn, F-I-N-N, for, I think, a web page that had, you know, travel to Finland. You know, what constitutes, you know, harassment or just kind of a silly claim, is a matter of difference of opinion, I think, sometimes. But, you know, there have been so few, I think, there are obviously, you know, one can argue about, you know, this case, this individual case or that individual case. But there have been really few that, you know, I think where anyone could, you know, raise an eyebrow and say, well, you know, that doesn't look like it went the right way.
Terrific. Let's see. Paul, do you want to come on and ask your question online? And so let me ask, are the determinations, are you finding the written determinations sufficient to understand the basis of the decision?
Yeah, that's probably a better question. Even if you disagree with the outcome, I think the reasoning is clear enough.
Okay. And we have a question from Paul McGrady. Can the ADR providers, I guess we're talking about the URS providers, address the process they use to select panelists and explain why John's information indicates a disproportionate selection of panelists? Oh, Paul Keating, I apologize. You guys can see the question in the chat. I'm not sure what Paul's getting at here.
Well, I think the question, how examiners are actually assigned, which is not specified, I believe, in the rules.
Yeah, I'm trying to paste a column from a spreadsheet into the chat. And it lost all the spacing. So the distribution, at least in terms of assignment of cases to panelists at NAF, is I'd say really flat. There's just really one or two panelists that you know, have gotten a disproportionate number of cases. And again, yeah, I mean, you have to remember the fees in this are very low. The time scale is short. So in assigning these to panelists, You know, you have to have someone who's, you know, ready to go for peanuts at a moment's notice. You know, I imagine that, you know, the fish that rise to the fast of the tank quickly are going to be getting this.
I would also add that WIPO, which is still accounts for, I think, more UDRP cases than any of the providers, is not a provider under the URS. So you've got a while there's an overlap of examiners or panelists between providers, you've got potentially a large pool of potential examiners who are UDRP panelists at WIPO, which is the busiest domain name dispute provider, who are simply not able to participate because for reasons that I'm sure are not appropriate to get back into in this discussion, WIPO chose not to become a URS provider.
Another question from the chat. Are the determinations translated in the same vein as notices?
I don't think so. I think they're in the in whatever language they are written in, which in most cases is English, but as we've talked about before, could be in another language.
And a question directed to you, Doug, but of course John can answer as well. Do the fees payable to panelists reasonably compensate them for preparing a proper decision that is of use to subsequent panelists and parties?
Well, it depends how you want to calculate that. Is it comparable to what an examiner's hourly fee is when engaging in private practice of law? Certainly not. But are there other reasons why that same attorney may choose to be an examiner and therefore find it worthwhile to do so? Certainly yes. So, and similarly, I would say UDRP decisions, while panelists are compensated at the forum and at WIPO more generously than for URS proceedings, UDRP proceedings typically require more time and effort from a panelist than a URS determination does. So I think the way John described it, examiners in URS cases have to be ready to go at a moment's notice for peanuts was an excellent way of capturing.
Well, and on the flip side of that, one of the conversations that we had during implementation of the URS was that if you need to spend more than 10 minutes thinking about it, then it's probably not a good URS case. Again, these are supposed to be, you know, sort of the obvious no-brainers to, you know, someone that knows one when they see it. So there shouldn't be a huge time investment. I know there's a certain amount of template-driven response or decision writing that certain UDRP providers use that can speed that up a bit.
Great. Thanks. And before we move on, John, could you just explain very quickly the numbers you just put into the chat?
Oh, yes. Those are the codes for the nuclear missiles. No. Those are the number of cases assigned to each URS examiner at the NAF, I think I made that 121 there is an error. The last numbers should be 11, 5, 4, 4, and 3. I was just putting spaces in because when I copied and pasted out of my column. So, I mean, yeah, there's, you know, one panelist that's gotten a few, but, you know, by and large, it's fairly flat. You know, most of the URS examiners have seen, you know, anywhere from 12 to 19 cases. Which on these numbers is, you know, reflects what Renee said. It appears to reflect that there's not any, you know, particular bias. And again, with that one examiner that's gotten the most of them, I mean, well, yeah, I haven't, like, you know, reviewed the cases or anything like that. That doesn't seem to stand out in terms of, yeah, 100% complaint granted, but that's, you know, that's true of quite a few of these. And again, it, you know, that's not necessarily reflective of anything.
Terrific. Thank you both. Mary, back to you. I think we're moving on to handling final determinations following a response in a default case.
Yes, we are indeed, Kathy. And being mindful of time, my suggestion is that for this slide and for some of the remaining ones, I believe we have something like four left. This one, as you said, talks about final determinations. The next one is about remedies, but some of these either relate back to the procedure or go into quite specific detail. Like for this one, we actually just provided the information to make clear that, you know, where you have a final determination, but there was a response, what happens? This just lays out some of the potential consequences where that is the case. So maybe I would just leave it there and remark really quickly, too, that in the next slide where we move on to remedies, obviously the remedy is prescribed in the procedure. So the rules really just make clear what actually happens mechanically and what information is displayed and changed. So maybe I'll just lump those two together. I don't know if Doug or John have comments on perhaps the final determinations in a case where there was a response that came in after default, and any comments they may have on handling of remedies as well.
Before we turn it over, Mary, could you go to the next slide just to emphasize something that was mentioned before, that the remedy is very narrow under the URS. It is suspension for the balance of the registration period, and the complainant has the option to extend that suspension for another year by paying the applicable fee. And one of the reasons that was put in was in case you were right at the expiration time. And then the thought was it could expire and the same person could re-register and you'd be back in the same URS proceeding. Doug, John, over to you. Any thoughts on remedies?
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on Claudio's comment. That's kind of a feature, not a bug. And I think that the reason why you see a much higher complainant success rate in the U.S. is that the idea was that, well, okay, if we're going to have sort of a UDRP-like quick and dirty and fast, and it didn't turn out to be necessarily as nimble a procedure as was envisioned, but the idea was that if these are going to be just sort of quick-look determinations, where the domain name is not going to get transferred, but the registrant's going to get fair warning. If there's some counterfeit situation going on, that's going to get taken down, in fairly short order. That was sort of the lack of transfer as a remedy is sort of the price you pay for the quick and dirty procedure itself. Certainly, I don't think anyone's gone back yet and taken a look at, you know, how often URS suspended domain name has, you know, been expired and then re-registered and so forth. And, you know, in a lot of the TLDs, the balance of them, the pricing is really not favorable for someone to just, you know, step up and do it again. I think what you have in a lot of these, and in a lot of the UDRP, is that you have what's going on with many of these cases is just you have people that are either somewhat ignorant or believe they've reinvented the wheel on, you know, oh hey, this famous trademark is available and I can register it, and then, you know, it's sort of they probably learned their lesson you know, in this one. Obviously, if you've got large-scale cyber squatters going on of, you know, say, you know, Zuccherini variety cyber squatters going on, that plays itself out in the EDRP. But given the short time scale, the fact that you could come in after a default, you know, I didn't get notice or whatever reason, and you don't have to worry about the mechanics of transferring the domain name back. I mean, the point was, if we make the procedure a little bit less onerous, then the remedy is a little bit light. But we have a tendency, I think, on all, in a lot of ICANN debates, to come up with these, you know, with these boogeymen. And so if, you know, yes, is it possible that someone can re-register them? Yeah. I used to re-register UDRP canceled domain names just for fun, just to prove what a silly thing I thought that was. And people still do it. But to say, well, you know, hypothetically, someone with some evil master plan to, you know, waste another $30 on a stupid UTLD domain name. yeah, they could do it, but it'd be more interesting to go and see if anyone's actually done that or if it is a problem, before, you know, looking for monsters under the bed. And that was my point about panelist experience. You know, does it appear to have been a problem? You know, no, just from the run of cases, is it a potential problem? Yeah. But, you know, saying, oh, well, someone could go re-register the name. Yeah, if they're dumb enough to do that, then yeah, they're probably dumb enough to do that. But part of the point with not having transfer was there was a large contingent in the IP constituency. And my favorite line, I think, was Sarah Deutsch famously said, I've got 40,000 domain names I don't want. And that the ability to turn them off without having to pay the registration fee, et cetera, and care and feeding and nurturing of the domain name, and to have that URL decision out there to refer to in the event that someone did pick it up again, was a little bit more of a convenience than running around with 40,000 domain names you don't want.
On the issue of extending the suspension for an additional year, there's a bit of ambiguity. The procedure simply says that there shall be an option for that. And then the rules state that the complainant shall contact the registry operator directly regarding this option. Yet when you file a URS complaint at the forum, at the time of filing the complaint, there's a requirement that you make an election at that time, whether if you prevail and get the domain name suspended, you wish to extend that suspension period for that 1 year. And I'll say in my own experience, there's been probably one of the larger challenges has been getting URS decisions, determinations actually implemented sometimes, let alone communicating with the registry operator and who's going to do that, whether it's the complainant or the service provider for the 1 year extension.
Terrific. Thanks. We're going to go to David McCulley and then to the questions in the chat. David, please.
Kathy, thanks. David McCulley speaking for the record. And I have an overall question. I thought I'd better jump in now before time runs out, but it has two facets. First of all, John and Doug, thank you very much for your presence. And I'm asking you as practitioners, if you can tell us whether there are any general protections for registries, that's the group I come from legal liability to registrants. And I say registrants purposefully because I see that the rules require the complainants to waive claims when they sign their complainant form. But that actually leads to the second facet of the question. How good are the providers in hewing to the URS rules and procedures? So I'm interested in general liability protection for registries from the registrant side and, you know, how well are the providers sticking to the rules and procedures. Thanks very much.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was the point of all of this, right, was that, you know, when the ACPA and the EDRP were being drafted in parallel, you know, St. Philip of Sparbro was on drafting committees. And, yeah, the point was to, at that time, protect the registrars. And that's why I mentioned that this is a, you know, this policy operates at the registry level. this is the mechanism by which registries can wash their hands of any liability either way, because the alternative is for, you know, registries to be making the calls on these things, and I think that would be a worse situation than any criticism of dispute policies. So, I mean, the only issue for registries is making sure that your staff, you know, knows them when they come in, because part of the problem with, you know, accreditation of various providers is that, you know, people get email kinds of sources. And, you know, I advise a couple of registries and a number of registrars. And, you know, like the first time a registrar, you know, even because these are rare, you know, all of these domain dispute procedures in terms of the day in, day out operations of domain registration are rare. And so I have seasoned registrar compliance people say, we got this email, do we have to do anything about it? You know, and it just happens to be the first time they've seen a UDRP come in from the ADN DRC. I mean, one of the only challenging, you know, things for the registry is that, because there are so many emails that come from so many places that people, you know, buy into when they register a domain name or operate a registry, you know, it would be fairly easy to spoof notices coming in from UDRP or URS providers. So you want to make sure your compliance people, you know one when they see one and are responsive to it. But that's about the only area where you get into trouble.
Terrific. Thanks for the question, David. Thanks for the response. Question from Jay Scott in the chat. And a quick note that we're at the 10-minute mark, and we still, like Mary, I'd love to get through the slides today and make sure that we can pick your brains about appeals and the handling of abusive complaints, which is some of the topics ahead. So unfortunately, we only have 10 minutes, so quick answers, please. Okay, so Jay Scott asks a two-part question. What about a remedy that's suspended for a year and then allowed the complainant to transfer at the end of the suspension period? He says, part two, or turn off the domain name, I assume he's saying the domain name at the end of the suspension, with a procedure for a party to turn back on for non-infringing use. Quick thoughts on that, please.
What about flies?
I would say it's a fascinating concept. It's not a part of the URS as it exists today. I certainly think a lot of trademark owners would like to see something like that.
John, go ahead, please.
Yeah, or what about fries or a large Coke? I mean, I've given up on, you know, the career of suggesting what the policy should be, but those are certainly great things to discuss for this group.
Great, thanks. Maxim, quickly, please.
Maxim Alzoba, for the record. I have a question to the way URS rules are written. If you check URS technical requirements, some legal obligations are hidden there. I think we should make a note. It must be reviewed on that the particular parts of text are moved to your rules PDF itself and not being hidden in technical part of documentation. Because, for example, the allowance to renew domain only for 1 year is hidden there. Thanks.
Oh, I agree completely, and yeah, there's a problem when bits and pieces of policies get, you know, hidden in other places. For example, I always tell people there's a piece of the UDRP that's hiding in the expired domain deletion policy with respect to, you know, names that expire during the UDRP. And yeah, in the course of advising registries and registrars on compliance and implementation of some of this stuff, you sometimes just have to be lucky to know where some of the requirements are. That is an excellent observation. It would be helpful if the policy itself included reference to the other technical implementation details, just so that there's one place where people can point to and refer to it, and you know, not get into overheated arguments with, you know, lawyers on telephones yelling at people at the registry, well, you're supposed to do this or that, would be extremely helpful.
Thanks, John. I'm hoping Doug is back. Maxim, is that a new hand?
New hand, just a few seconds.
Okay.
Registry's obligations about the inclusion of particular text to registrar contracts are also hidden there. So not the party trying to complain is confused, but registry is confused too. So I suggest from this perspective too that we suggest change of formatting, I'd say. Thanks.
Maxim, thank you. Confusion is not what we want. Fair notice for everyone is what we want. Mary, it looks like we're quiet for a second in the chat, so let me throw it back to you to take us through the rest of the slides. Thank you. And let me just pause for a second. Doug, are you back with us? Okay, we may still be waiting for Doug. Mary, back to you. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. I think Doug is dialing back in. And in the interest of time, as you noted before, the remaining slides deal with a couple of things that we can probably get through this part quickly and turn over for questions and comments. It's a clear principle that having a determination under the URS does not affect the availability of remedies under either the UDRP or filing of judicial proceedings. One of the things that we thought we might highlight for the group in respect of this topic is that the examiner does have a certain amount of discretion here, not just about parallel ongoing legal proceedings, but as you see in the last bullet point here, where the parties obviously agree to settle, or if it becomes unnecessary or impossible to continue, and we've reproduced the actual language here. So it's interesting that the examiner does have some discretion that's all stated in the rules. And this actually does allow us to then look at the appeals stage where, again, it is the procedure that specifies the time frame and the timeline, and the rules just enhance and explain some of that. The rules also go on to specify the mechanics of what has to happen. So if an appeal is from a determination that was in the respondent's favor, you know, what it is that the providers and registry operators must do. And in addition, there is clarity as to the limit of the remedies available on appeal that we've listed in this next slide. Affirmation, overruling of the initial determination or the examiner's finding. And there is the requirement we stated earlier to publish the determination of the appeal as well. So I see that Doug is back, but I'll just flash the next slide, which is really the last substantive slide. We've mentioned in a few places that there is the possibility of abusive complaints. What constitutes abuse or deliberate material falsehood were matters that we discussed briefly in a prior session because these are defined in the underlying procedure. So again, as with other steps in the process, the rules basically explain what can be done, the mechanics if certain consequences happen, for example, if there is a finding of abuse. So I'm going to unlock the slides here so that folks can go back and forth. And I don't know, Doug and John, if you have comments about either abusive complaints or how appeals are handled or the examiner's discretion to terminate URS proceedings, which is what these last few topics have been.
I've never been involved in a proceeding with an allegation of an abusive complaint, and frankly, I'm not aware of any. I would love to be corrected if that has ever been an issue in a URS proceeding.
Yeah, I don't know that it has been. I haven't seen it either. I haven't looked at all the cases, but you know, there are sometimes situations where, you know, the a complaint is very silly. And EDRT panelists have a variety of different, you know, approaches to that. There's the, the complainant was, you know, was too dumb or inexperienced to know what they were doing. You know, there's sort of too much of an idiot to have, you know, filed a competent complaint in the first place, which, you know, it's kind of odd because most of the time that's the story on the respondent side. You know, it's sort of a little, you know, Cupid doll at the carnival. So a URS examiner said it was abusive. Now, you can leverage that in, you know, further civil proceedings after a domain dispute case. There is, regardless of what the rules, you know, say an abusive complaint is or is not, there's going to be a difference of opinion on, you know, was this just frankly so silly that we should, you know, penalize the complainant on the way out the door. And there is kind of a principle that, well, you know, where you have a procedure where complainants can, you know, choose the provider and they pay the fees, you know, there's some kind of a question as to how much, you know, how much discipline you want to apply to your own customers. But I don't get excited over the those things too much.
Great. Thank you, John. Thank you, Doug. Anybody with questions about appeals, termination, or abusive complaints? In that case, we have come to the bottom of the meeting, and I would very much like to thank staff for preparing excellent slides and Mary for taking us through them, and for Doug and John for sharing their expertise, deep expertise, and an hour and a half of their time more for all the preparation you did preparing for the meeting. We really appreciate the discussion, and lest I get a no, can we invite you back for more discussion if appropriate?
Back for more. Yeah, sure. I do have one other comment to make on abusive complaints, because there is something of a tie-in to the new GTLD process where, you know, if someone has abused the URS or the EDRP more than three times, then they can't get a new GTLD or something like that. And no one's ever come close. One of the interesting issues about the way that that's praised in at least the tie-in to the new GTLD program is who is it that has been, you know, who is it that really was the abusive party in a domain dispute proceeding where there was a party that was represented by an attorney who obviously, you know, counseled this person to go ahead and do that. And if it was abusive itself, you know, do we look at the complainant or do we look at the attorney who did it? Because there's junior associates can do fairly easy work in going through, you know, client trademark portfolios and upselling clients on domain dispute proceedings. And you know, there do seem to have been a few firms that, you know, have repetitively, you know, filed abusive EDRP complaints. These, you know, it's not clear in the tie-in to the GTLD program, you know, who we're looking at here, or in terms of disqualifying them from filing other domain dispute proceedings or so forth, whether we're looking at the party represented or the attorney who counseled filing a proceeding that was deemed abusive. One other point I did miss, and then I'll shut up, is on the supplemental rules thing, where there was a note to the effect that the URS overrides any conflict with supplemental rules. It's the provider who's going to be making that determination as to whether or not their supplemental rules do or do not comport with the URS. And I'm certain there's no provider that would say there is a conflict. And likewise, the supplemental rules, sometimes the differences can be substantial. You know, it is a very different, in the context of the EDRP, it is a very different scenario when I'm dealing with, say, a EDRP at the CAC, the NAF, or the WIPO, and you have to be sensitive to, you know, those differences in rules. But there does not seem to be any particular review mechanism I mean, there shouldn't be a conflict between the supplemental rules and the domain dispute policy rules. But there is no review mechanism for provider supplemental rules such that anyone would catch a conflict if there were to be one.
Interesting. We haven't gotten the supplemental rules yet, but the idea of a review mechanism to make sure they don't contradict the URS rules makes sense, at least to me. John, thank you. I'm going to call those your concluding thoughts since we're at 2:33, but I don't want to log off, and I know people are leaving. Doug, would you like to share some concluding thoughts as well?
No, given that we're over, okay. over time, and hopefully it looks like we were able to get to all of the questions, and I would just, you know, I think the process is still just not frequently used, and therefore it's one that many are still learning about.
And we are learning from you, so thank you both for sharing so much time and information. Thanks much, and thanks for everybody. We had a great crowd today. Thanks for everybody for attending. Both members and observers attended this meeting. And that's it from the working group. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Operator Harvey, if you could please stop all recordings. To everyone else, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.